Log Talk Radio.
Sports' cleanup hitters coming to you here on another Tuesday evening. A little bit later now into the summertime we go as we're coming to you here on August now 11th. I said the other day on my Saturday program, it's all just got a different feel to it all of a sudden, doesn't it? Baseball's kind of, as soon as you get that football feel going, suddenly baseball sort of gets that end of season feel to it, and that's kind of where we are at this point. And I guess we're going to be kind of talking about it, that is baseball, tonight a little bit, almost as if it is in its coming kind of final days, as we're going to be talking a little bit of, well, continuing post-trade conversations, post-trade deadline conversations, and also we'll also be looking at a couple of teams as, analysts are already making some bold predictions for both the AL East and the NL East. And, well, it's not what I think everybody was expecting at the very beginning of the season. But we'll get into a little bit of that as we're going to start prognosticating about what things will look like, I guess, in about 6 weeks from now. But shortly in here, in just about 15 minutes or so, we're going to be joined in here by a very special guest. We're going to be joined in here by Billy Brost of Baseball Magazine. And while that might sound all rather, passe, I must tell you, and I'm not going to give it away, Billy's got a great story about this magazine, and I'm going to leave it for him to tell. If you are a vintage baseball person, somebody who perhaps maybe even has done even a little bit of memorabilia collecting, even going back to, say, the 60s and the 50s. Billy's got quite a story for you here, and he's going to be talking about it. And I think that's what makes Billy Brost so darn fascinating. In the meantime, let me get in our usual panel of folks. Let me get Sean in here first. Sean, how you doing, buddy?
Good, Fraz. Mike, how you doing?
All right, man. All right. And let's get Nick in here as well. Nick, all good there on what are you? I guess you'd be on the east, northeastern front.
Yeah, I'm on the out northeast, I guess you could say.
Yeah, northeast for me, anyhow. Northeastern front, yeah, all good there. All right, good. As I said, we got Billy Brost jumping in here with us, and I guess about 10 minutes or so. So let's jump around. Let's jump around here real quick, and we'll get into our usual show starting highlights, and that means I got to borrow Caleb's sports machine
tonight,
here.
Through the use of the sports machine.
There you go. There are no games that are going on currently, but there are a bunch of games that are about to get underway. 7 o'clock start for the Blue Jays, who are hosting the Oakland A's. Those New York Yankees, we're watching them closely, and we're going to be talking about them a little bit this evening. The New York Yankees are on the road in Cleveland, taking on the Cleveland Indians. That's a 7:10 start. 7:10 start as well. The New York Mets are hosting the Colorado Rockies. That's not something the Washington Nationals, I'm sure, are very appreciative of. The 7:10 start here, Miami Marlins are hosting the Boston Red Sox. Yes, you can yawn. And the Tampa Bay Rays, also 7:10 down there in Florida, hosting the Atlanta Braves. there you go. Those are our 7 o'clock games. There were no games during the day today in Major League Baseball. There you are. We're up to date on that. How about we take a look at the power rankings? Why not? We have been doing it every week. Interesting couple of observations that I made on it in our notes, gentlemen. I had my notes exactly ready. Hold your breath. Here come the Blue Jays and here come the Cubs. Well, isn't it funny? We were just talking about them last week, huh? Toronto Blue Jays moved up 4 spots. They're now number 4 in all of the power rankings. Not number 4 in Major League Baseball, but number 4 on the power rankings. 55-52 record. They jumped up to the number 4 spot, as I said, from moving up 4 spots. Chicago Cubs moved up 5 spots and taking over the 6th place position. The Cubbies, 62-48. You know, I don't know. You know, we talked about it a little bit last week. Did they miss the boat on perhaps not being buyers? And ultimately, Nick, you made the perfect point, and I agreed with you completely. Boy, they're not going to win the Central Division. So just sit tight. They certainly did have themselves quite a nice 10 games now so far. 9-1 in their last 10, and they're on a winning streak of 4. I guess in their last 10, they got to be one of the hottest teams in baseball. I don't know. Should they have been buyers? We can go back and talk about it for 2 seconds here. What do you think, Nick?
I would say yes, other than the fact that they weren't buyers and they seem to be doing pretty well. So I still don't know that it was a necessarily bad decision not to be buyers. Would it have helped? Sure.
All right. Where else was I going to go? Anything else jumping off the page at you guys that you saw? We're going to get into conversations here before the evening's done about the Mets and the Nationals and also about the Yankees and the Toronto Blue Jays, so we can leave that one alone for those conversations in a bit. I don't know. Anything else jumping out of here at you?
I would just like
this past week? Go ahead.
For everyone on this panel and everyone listening in from the Philadelphia area, the Phillies no longer have the worst record in the MLB. Let's all put our hands together. We did it. We made it. Finally.
Hold on. Yeah. I was actually looking for the golf clap, but that one, I couldn't put my hands on that one right away. The golf clap probably would have been more appropriate. Actually, no. You know, with all due respect, you know, a lot of people are talking about this Philadelphia Phillies team and pointing out how well they have played. Going back to, I guess, what, the All-Star break, really. Not even the trade deadline. Let's go back to the All-Star break. I think they've, what, only lost something like 5 or 6 games since the All-Star break completely? And some now are actually talking about should it kind of be considered for the managerial position at the beginning of next season. Hey, both you guys are Phils fans. Both you guys follow them. I don't know. What do you think?
I say, yeah, I think he's done a good job. I was speaking, yesterday, I think, with somebody about maybe taking the interim tag off. I think it's too early to do that because we saw too much of a sample size, and I don't want to guarantee McCann the spot with this club next year as the manager, but from what we've seen so far, it's not even just a matter of the wins and losses with this team. It's the way they're playing, the way he's handling this team. I thought he has done a great job as manager, both from a strategical standpoint and from a getting the players to play well standpoint. Every game he wins makes Sandberg look that much worse. I don't know if I would tell you I want him for sure as the manager next year, but I think he's absolutely – they don't have to play 16-5 ball the rest of the way, but if they can play just good baseball like they've been playing the rest of the way, I would absolutely consider him for the position next season.
And I'd have to agree with Nick pretty much 100%. I mean, he's done a great job of really rallying this team together and whipping him into shape, I guess. I mean, he had to have done something over the All-Star break to kind of break these guys, like, hey, we need to do something different. And he's doing a good job of kind of coaching a very young team. As we're seeing, there's a lot of the younger guys are really starting to step up, play well. So I think he should be considered to stay in the managerial position, but I don't think you know, it should be like a guaranteed thing at the end of the season, because if they could find someone who's maybe a little more experienced and could handle this team just as well as he did, I think you could take that route as well.
I would agree. McCann, you know, I agree with you, Nick, to take the interim tag off, and I'm going to be honest with you, I wouldn't take it off at any time during the course of this season at all. Don't take it off, period. Just leave it right where it is. Everything's fine. Hey, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. What we're going to do is we're going to fix it maybe at the end of the season. Should he be considered? Yeah. Why not? Consider him. You know, no big deal there. You know, let him be considered along with some others, and we'll see where it goes at that point. You know, it was interesting because we got to hear some of Jimmy Rollins' comments about Ryan Sandberg when he was in town last week. And, I mean, I've got no reason to think that Jimmy Rollins had an axe to grind or anything. Look, Ryan Sandberg's not here any longer. I think Rollins was being honest when he said, you know, the guy's communication skills weren't exactly perhaps maybe the best for what a manager should have been. I was disappointed to hear that because I've been a Ryan Sandberg fan, but I wasn't surprised by his comments. And perhaps maybe that's all it took. Perhaps maybe all it has taken has been to bring somebody in here who is a little more outgoing, a little more resourceful in communicating with his players. You know, we've heard this before. You guys can attest to it, I think, at least, maybe not per se at this level, but you've brought it up, what the differences are between this level and other levels below it. The managers here aren't coaches. They're managers. Their number one job is personnel, is to keep everybody together and working on the same track. And all right, so maybe he puts together a batting order every once in a while and decides what the starting rotation's going to be. Aside from that, he's not really coaching. So manager has to be that glue that keeps things together. And it would seem that, based on Jimmy Rollins' comments, well, Sandberg just wasn't that guy. Starts to make you wonder whether Sandberg will get another managerial position. Any thoughts on Rollins' comments? I think both of you probably weren't surprised by him as well. I think Nick, you actually kind of predicted him.
Yeah, I said this a little while ago. I don't doubt that Sandberg could be a good coach in at the big league level. I just don't think he is manager material, and I was not shocked by all the comments Jimmy Rollins had made when he was in Philadelphia about Sandberg. I wasn't even shocked, but if you were to ask me what I thought Jimmy would say, presented the question, that basically would have been it. I'm not against Sandberg. I have nothing against the guy as a coach, as a person, as a man, as a manager, whatever it may be. I just, from what I saw, did not think he was quite manager material. And if you remember, when he did step down, there was a lot of discussion around Philadelphia saying, or even around the nation, and it was about, you know, how could you really judge this man fairly? Look at the team he has. What could he possibly do? Like I said 5 minutes ago, every game McCann wins makes Sandberg look that much worse, because now McCann's proven to him with a team without Cole Hamels and without Jonathan Papelbon and without Ben Revere, he's proven that this team might not be a 16-5 record, or it might not be a 16-5 team, but it's a team that can play baseball and that can compete and that can fight when they're down four runs in the ninth inning, and that can pull out a sweep over another team in the league. He's proven that there are other teams in this league that have lineups that are just as bad, that have pitching rotations that are just as bad, yet they're 10 wins ahead of us, 15 wins ahead of us, and we question why, and we say, well, maybe they are that much better. And McCann looks to the team, and he looks to us and says, no, this team's not good. They're not going to make the playoffs. They're not a 500 team. They're not going to win the division. It's just not going to happen. But this team is a lot better than the way they've been playing. Look at what I can get out of these players. Look at what I can put on the field. It's not a championship team, but I'm going to go out and I'm going to throw out good baseball out there. And I think every night he gets his guys to do that, it's just more evidence behind the fact that Sandberg just was not a good manager, and it had nothing to do with the fact that his team stunk.
He's not doing anything to get those kids to play. And let's get it straight. That's basically what we're looking at. We're looking at a lot of prospects right now on the Phil's team. He's not doing anything, I think, to really get them to play harder, Nick. He's isn't he just creating the atmosphere that makes them want to play? Wouldn't that be more appropriately what's going on?
I think what you just described are very similar. I don't think he's going to the locker room every day in the morning going, all right, guys, you know, let's get this W. If we win today, win tomorrow, win the next day, we're right back into things. I really want to see you guys all play your heart out. I don't think that's what he's doing. But I think the fresh face, the different attitude, the way he interacts with his players, and I don't know what goes on behind the scenes because I haven't been there, but just from what you hear and from what you can kind of infer from just watching from afar, I don't know exactly what's different, but he's definitely different than Sandberg, and I don't know if he specifically is going around to every individual player, getting them to play at their best, but players will play better for specific managers. If you're playing for a guy you want to play for or that treats you a certain way or that talks to you a certain way or sets the lineup a certain way, then they'll play harder for you. And that's not a conscious decision. It's just the way things happen. I think McKinnon, you know, I don't know if he's a gung-ho, sis-boom, rah-rah type of guy, but I absolutely have played harder for McKinnon, and I don't know if that's his intentional doing, but you look at this team and... It's not just luck. It's not just the way the lineup's been set up. It's this team's playing harder. They're playing smarter. They've got their heads in the game. You're seeing less stupid mistakes. When players make errors, they get right back up. They don't hang their head. They don't feel down when you get down a run. With Sandberg, you got down a run or two early in the game. Your shoulders kind of sank. Game was over.
Mm-hmm.
Down four runs against the Dodgers in the ninth inning, and they were 6 inches away from Adrian Gonzalez not robbing Dominic Brown with a shot down the line that was probably going to land foul, but if it landed fair, might have tied the game in the ninth inning. It's the way these kids play, and I don't know what Sandberg is doing and whether it's intentional or unintentional, but it's hard to deny that the players are playing the same way they did for Sandberg. There's something that's different, and it's not the lineup, it's not the Ken Giles closing 6 of 12 games. It's the way every single one of them are playing. And I don't know what specifically it is, but absolutely these guys are playing different for McKinnon than they did for Sandberg.
Yep. I that's what it certainly appears. That's for darn sure. We're going to get back into a little bit of this because I want to get into a little bit of the conversation about a couple of guys that are still being talked about with regard to trade possibilities, particularly on the fields, and one of them is Chase Utley. We'll get into that, though, before this night's over. What I want to get into is I want to bring in a guest of ours. That's Billy Brost, coming to us from Wyoming. Wyoming, Billy, is that where you're coming to us from tonight?
That's where I'm coming to you from tonight. How you doing, guys?
Real good. We appreciate you being here with us on Cleaning Up Hitters.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us what are things like at this time of year in Wyoming? Because we're all the way out here in Pennsylvania. And yet the shadows are getting a little bit longer right now as we're in mid-August. What are things like in Wyoming in August?
You're starting to see some signs of fall creeping in, even though it's still very hot out here. You're starting to see the elk move around a little bit. And like you said, the shadows, they're starting to creep in a little bit. Things are starting to change. I've seen a couple trees look like the leaves are starting to change just a little bit, but it's still very much summer here in Wyoming right now.
Now, talk to me about your background. Are you originally from that area, or are you from back here in the east?
No, I'm originally from Oregon. I grew up in the Columbia River Gorge in a little town called The Dalles. And my wife is from Wyoming. She grew up in this community, and her family is here. And I don't have a lot of family left. I was an only child. My father passed away a few years ago, and my mom actually just moved to Pennsylvania here a couple months ago. She lives in Coryville. So,
okay. I guess what had me a little bit confused, Billy, is that every time I see your picture, well, there's that New York Yankees emblem on the hat. And I'm thinking, well, there must have been some Eastern influence. Obviously, you are a Yankees fan, I would imagine.
Yeah, I'm a diehard Yankees fan. I'll tell you where my fandom for the Yankees came from. Like I said, I grew up in the Pacific Northwest in the 80s and early 90s. And I was not a fan of the regional teams, that being the Seahawks, the Mariners, the Sonics, the Blazers. My parents took me to a Mariners-Yankees game for my birthday when I was 5. And I got to see both Reggie and Dave Winfield go yard in the Kingdom. And I was in love with the Bronx Bombers from that point on. I grew up a huge Don Mattingly fan. Donnie Baseball is my guy. I think he's getting a bad rap out in L.A., and I would love to see him return to the Bronx where he belongs. And I just was a Yankee fan from that point ever since. My dad used to go on business trips when I was little, and when he would go back east during the summer, sometimes he would take me. And I remember seeing in Yankee Stadium, old Yankee Stadium, and there'd be 3,000 people in the stands, and you could literally hear the vendor all the way across the ballpark hollering for peanuts and beer. That's how empty Yankee Stadium was. I was a big Billy Martin guy. And, you know, to me, Billy Martin is the end-all and be-all when it comes to baseball strategists. So, you know, my heart lies on the East Coast. My oldest daughter lives in New Jersey, about 15 minutes outside of New York City. And so I do have some East Coast ties now.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, I just to go back on your story there, and that's what I'm looking for from you tonight, Billy, is our stories. And I'm going to get to your big story here in a moment. But when you were out there to that Yankees-Mariners game, what year was that?
It was 1981.
81, okay. All right. So that would have been well before – that was well before Ken Griffey. Okay. All right. I thought you had actually said it was like the. I thought you said it was 90s. Okay, 81. Yeah, it was well before Ken Griffey.
By a long shot.
Yep. I want to get into. You've got something going called Baseball Magazine, and I started out at the top of the show, and I said, well, for those of you that aren't familiar with Baseball Magazine, you might be sitting here saying, well, that's. Has a rather passe name to it, and yet that would also mean that they have absolutely no idea what the history of Baseball Magazine is. And I said, that's why you've got to be listening when we've got Billy on, because I'm going to let Billy tell the story of it. Have got control of something that's got a lot of history to it. Go ahead and tell us.
Well, I do. You know, Baseball Magazine was first published in 1907. By a gentleman named Jacob Morse. He was a sports writer based out of Boston. He had authored a couple of books in the early part of the 20th century. And what's unique about Baseball Magazine at the time was that it was the very first monthly baseball publication dedicated strictly to baseball. Sometimes you'd see a football article or a poem, something like that, but it was before Sports Illustrated. It was before Baseball Digest. It was before the Sporting News. Baseball Magazine was the publication of record for baseball fans in the early part of the 20th century. Mr. Morse stayed for a couple of years and then passed the baton on to a gentleman named F.C. Lane. And Mr. Lane ran the program until its demise in the late 1950s. And he had relocated the offices from Boston to New York City, and then it just ceased publication because of the rise in popularity of Sports Illustrated, the Sporting News, Life Magazine, all these other publications. They just couldn't compete. So Baseball Magazine basically went by the wayside. It died. And what got me involved was that my grandfather, who's no longer with us, he basically got me into being a sports fan. He was a sports guy. I'd spend a lot of time with him as a small child, and we would watch Wide World of Sports every Saturday, whatever it was, game of the week, it didn't matter. We watched sports. And he kept a lot of things of historic relevance around his home. One of those things were back issues of Baseball Magazine. And I, as a little guy, I was enthralled by the colors, by seeing the old pictures of the baseball players, and I would have him explain it to me, and he would read me stories out of it. Well, fast forward a couple of years, you know, my love of baseball never ceased at that point, but my love of history began growing. And my father, being the businessman that he was, said, hey, you know, I can do some digging and see if this is available. And I said, what do you mean available? And he said, every company, every business has a trademark and a copyright. And he said, if it's available out there, I think you should buy it. Okay, this is 1986, 1987 at this point. He did the research. He found out that it was, you know, in the public domain. No one had re-registered for it. So I took my allowance, and I purchased Baseball Magazine, the brand. And I have held on to that for almost 30 years now, 30,
wow.
35 years.
That's awesome.
And you know, it's always something I've wanted to do. I've just been too busy. You know, life gets in the way. You know, I'm married. I have children. I was going to college. I was playing football. I was doing all sorts of things. Well, and, you know, my recent stop in terms of writing was in the Fansided Network. I was the editor of both Yanks Go Yard, the Yankee site, and Friars on Base, the Padres site. And I was just getting tired of being tired all the time. I was recruiting. I was promoting. I was writing. I had a great co-editor with me, Jason Evans, and I said, you know what, I've had enough. I want to do something that I want to do. I want to get out of the racket. So I purchased two domains. One is where our site is currently located, baseballmagazine.net. The other is thebaseballmagazine.com. I've stuck one in my back pocket. I've launched the site. What we did was we issued a couple of mini issues. I assembled a staff of writers that I've worked with, that I've known for 20, 25 years now, going back to my teens, guys that I've known, guys I've trusted, that not only have a passion for baseball, but have a passion for history and baseball history, and understand that it's different than writing a blog or a news piece. We're taking historical content and we're putting a contemporary spin on it. We're breathing new life into old topics. And I know it's a niche, but baseball's got a lot of history, and unlike any other professional sport, people cherish that history. They wrap themselves around it. I mean, everyone knows what 4256 means. You know, everyone knows what 56-game hitting streak means. Those pass from generation to generation to generation, and I thought, why not gather people that are passionate about it, that are knowledgeable about it, and breathe new life into something that has been dear to me since I was a small child.
Give me an idea of what you're talking about. I guess give me an example of what you're talking about when you say you're taking historical – how did you phrase it? You're taking historical – stories and breathing new life into it. Go ahead. Yeah. Give me an example of that.
Well, one of my writers, Charlie Spencer Davis, recently wrote a piece for our first full issue, which came out Hall of Fame weekend, examining the future of the 300-game winner. And basically he looked back through time, starting with the dead ball era, and looked at how many starts guys made per career, a guy like Cy Young, a guy like Walter Johnson, all the way through Koufax, Drysdale, Gibson, all the way through to today's player. And the argument he's basically making is that we will never see another 300-game winner, ever, because it's just not plausible anymore. The days of guys making 45 starts, those days are over. If they get 30 starts, that's a lot. Guys are on pitch counts. Guys feel twinge, they're going under the knife, on and on and on. It's a different game today than it was 50, 60, 100 years ago. So that's an example of something that has historical relevance, because everyone knows that a 300-game winner is Cooperstown bound unless your name's Roger Clemens. That'll mm-hmm. never happen. But it was interesting to read the list. I wasn't aware of the list off the top of my head until Charlie discussed it in his piece of who are who the active leaders are in Major League Baseball and wins, and how hard it is to get the 300 wins, and the fact that there are several active guys that are close to 200 wins or have over 200 wins that will never sniff the 300-win plateau. It's just never going to happen again. So I thoroughly enjoyed editing that piece and sharing it. And those are the type of pieces we look at. I wrote a piece recently about Alex Rodriguez and Pete Rose. I put their careers into historical relevance, and then I brought in the off-the-field issues. Obviously, with Rose, it's the gambling, you know, the new news that he gambled as a player. A-Rod, the suspension, the failed anonymous test. You know, you try and put those into historical relevance, and the public, for the most part, wants Pete Rose back in the game, or at least Cooperstown eligible. I would never hand him a baseball job. But, Pete Rose is beloved by generations of baseball fans, not because he was a gambler, because he was Charlie Hustle. And for Alex Rodriguez, he's had a nice bounce-back year this year. He's still under contract for a couple more years. We literally, a couple years from now, could be talking about Alex Rodriguez as the all-time home run king. Well, mm-hmm. Do you put him in the same light as Barry Bonds, who literally grew 2 inches in height? His head size grew, his shoe size grew. Alex Rodriguez's body never really changed, per se. It's just we know he was using something. Again, it's the argument, do steroids help a guy hit a ball 500 feet? Do steroids help a guy hit the ball out 600 times in his career? And it seems with Alex keeping his mouth shut for once and just playing baseball, he's starting to once again endear himself to the fans. I'm not sure the media is ever going to forgive him, but that begs the question. Do either of these guys deserve forgiveness? And again, I put the historical context of their careers into that argument.
Well, we could have you on for the next hour talking that one. I mean, for gosh sakes, I'm going to tell you right now, because we've talked about that one a lot right here. To get to this, though, again, to go back to this, it's you're answering my question, which is what I assumed, because I have taken a look at a number of the articles over on the website. You're not forgetting, you're not ignoring what's going on in today's landscape of baseball. You're just taking a different approach to it, more of a historical approach. As opposed to telling us what happened in last night's game, your mission is more to look at it from an overall perspective in how it fits into baseball history. Would that be accurate?
That would be very accurate. And you know what, we're hoping to dig a little bit deeper. The more issues we come out with, the more material we're creating. We're looking to dig a little bit deeper into just some hardcore historical issues that maybe fans were not aware of existed. For example, there's going to be a series that comes out in September's issue by a good friend of mine named David Warren. I went to grad school with Dave at UNLV. We're both UNLV graduates. Dave said, hey, I need a topic. Give me something interesting that no one has done before. I said, well, you live there in Las Vegas. You're a school teacher. I said, you got a few weeks before school starts. I said, I want to know the history of professional and semi-professional baseball in the city of Las Vegas. Because people say Las Vegas and baseball, they think the 51s. They think the Stars.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Well, in recent days, Dave has uncovered that there were multiple teams in the 1940s and early 1950s that we've never heard about, players we've never heard about. The actual first professional block baseball player that came out of the state of California prior to Jackie Robinson played some professional baseball in Las Vegas. So we're going to do a bio on him. But those are the type of historical topics that we feel baseball fans want, care about, and are interested in reading about. So that, you know, we're trying to do the contemporary direction. We're trying to look at some historical content, and we've got a lot of things ahead of us for the site that we're wanting to do overall as well.
It's fascinating, fascinating stuff, and you're absolutely right. While I can understand that you're concerned that it might be a niche sort of thing, it absolutely is filling a vacuum of information that is out there. And you're doing it in a really, really classy and classical sort of way. Right now, all of your content is digital only on the Internet. Is that correct? It's over at baseballmagazine.net. Is that's the way it is right now, correct?
That is correct. And right now what we're working on, my associate editor, Dan Hughes, he is putting together our first digital downloadable magazine copy. Mm-hmm. And that copy is going to be available on Maxer and Google digital download. And what we decided to do, rather than just take the web content and slap it in a magazine for download, we made the decision as a staff that we're also going to include some digital download exclusive content that you will not see on the website. So it's going to push folks towards downloading that or opening it up and giving it a read and seeing what else is in there that they didn't access from the website. That's just one part of what we're doing. I have a videographer, Eric Becker, who's written a couple pieces on the late Brian Traxler. He was literally got a cup of coffee with the Los Angeles Dodgers. He's very good friends with Mr. Traxler's widow, Gabby, down in San Antonio. He went down there, did some research, wrote a couple pieces on the late Brian Traxler. He's established our YouTube page, and on the Baseball Magazine YouTube channel, Eric, being based out of Los Angeles, is going to start conducting interviews and historical field trips that are relevant to baseball and baseball history. Those are going to be, again, YouTube-exclusive content that you won't find on the website. And then the big monster that I'm tackling, along with a couple of my writers, is that we are attempting to build a complete digital archive of every back issue of Baseball Magazine from 1907 through the end of 1957.
That is so cool.
That will be available for download to fans. And as we gain, as we gain files, we'll be posting them. And that's the big monster. Once we do that, I'll feel like where we need to be in terms of education, research, content, all of that.
And for any of the old school folks that are out there, and I'm not saying I'm one of them, but for any of the old school folks out there who like to have that paper copy in their hand, you'll be able to, actually print this out. Now, is it going to be just 20 cents, Billy?
I'll be honest, right now I'm thinking about making it free to see what type of traffic we get. I'm thinking about making it free, and then as we build our audience, maybe bumping it up to $2.99 per issue. And again, it's there's going to be magazine exclusive content that cannot be found anywhere on the site, anywhere on social media. It's going to be strictly right there. So, it's a little bit of a carrot to get our audience to download or eventually purchase that. But with my background in education and my field being history, I always was upset coming through the ranks as a young writer, as a college student, as a graduate student, where I would have to pay to access things. Because a college student doesn't have a lot of money in his pocket.
Right.
And this isn't a money-making entity for me. I'm doing this, I feel, as an obligation to my love of the game and to the sport. And if I can make it relatively affordable or easily accessible for the next generation of baseball historian and writer, or someone who's just discovering the game and wants to know the past, as I did as a child, I want that there for them. I want that resource there for them, because right now there is no resource for them unless you're willing to have a paid membership into any slew of baseball research organizations that are out there.
Billy, we've got a regular caller, Richard, from New York online. He is a baseball writer himself. Do you have any problem taking a question or two from Richard?
Not at all.
Let's get Richard in here. Richard, thanks for calling us up again, as usual, on Cleanup Hitters. We've got Billy Brost on the line from Wyoming, and he is the founder and the editor-in-chief of Baseball Magazine. Do you remember
That's
this
great.
Magazine, Richard? Do you remember it? I'm just out of curiosity.
No, I don't remember it. No, I remember Sport Magazine.
Okay. What's on your mind tonight, Richard?
Well, I wanted to ask your guest – his thoughts on Juan Marichal and Warren Spahn, two pitchers who I followed when I was a boy growing up.
Warren Spahn and Juan Marichal, in my mind, are two of the most underrated pitchers of all time. When you talk about that era, you know, I remember studying and reading and always hearing the saying, Spahn insane and pray for rain, which, you know, the Braves had Johnny Sane and Warren Spahn and not much else. And you know, my recollection and background with Warren Spahn is that he's arguably the greatest left-hander of all time. And people say, what about Koufax? What about Johnson? Well, what people forget, looking at, you know, because numbers don't always tell the story. Just like with Bob Feller, Warren Spahn stopped his big league career and went and served our country. And I think in historical relevance, I think his numbers do him an injustice because he was so dominant and he was so great for all those Braves teams for so many years. I lived in Atlanta briefly, got to go through the Braves Museum. I got to see Warren Spahn's Purple Heart and several of the items from his military career. And being a veteran myself, it was very impressive and honorable that the Braves recognized that portion of his career. Juan Marichal, I mean, what can you say? I mean, he was an original. He was Pedro before there was Pedro.
Yep.
I mean, the crazy, you know. Everything he did,
you couldn't hit off of him.
Yeah, you couldn't hit off of him, and he was dominant for a lot of years for those Giants teams. You know, you always heard about Mays, you always heard about McCovey, and maybe Juan Marichal fell somewhere, you know, underneath that specter.
Yeah,
I mean,
he did.
You hear more about the brawl with the Dodgers catcher than you do about his career, and that's a shame.
I agree.
It's a shame that a benches clearing brawl and one mistake, because everyone's human, has defined his career more than what he did on the mound, because he was such a dynamic personality and he was so dominant. I mean, the Giants weren't the Giants without Juan Marichal. I mean, you put Mays and McCovey in there all day long, but if they don't have anybody pitching, those Giants teams aren't getting past the Dodgers ever at any point. So,
all right. Yeah. Well, Richard, we appreciate you calling in again this week. Make sure you keep listening. All right, man.
All right. Take care.
All right.
Thanks,
thank
Richard.
Bye bye.
Richard does a little writing. I'm trying to remember which website he is working with. He covers. I believe he does a little covering of the. I know he's from Chicago. Big Cubs fan and a big. Bears fan, but he does a little writing as well for one of the websites.
Are all you guys Phillies fans? Are you guys all Philly diehard Phillies guys?
Well, the panel that you've got on here tonight, yes, are Phillies fans. However, we do have others that jump in with us on different shows, and we've got Pirates fans, and we got Yankees fans, and so it does get mixed up a little bit. It just so happens this evening, I guess of the three of us here, right, guys, it's the Phils that we put them as our number one.
Yeah.
Well, I'll share a little tidbit with you real quick. I've had my own fantasy baseball league for about a decade. We're in our 10th year, and we've had owners come and go. Well, the entry to get into my league, it's a baseball history question. I say, what is Mike Schmidt's full name? Because he was one of my favorite players growing up. And I had a young guy about 22, 23 years old, looked at me and said, who's Mike Schmidt? I said, you're
out.
Oh,
no.
No, you know, because I remember as a child, you know, when I'd be back east with my father, getting to tune into the radio or getting to tune into TV if we had a layover, and hearing Harry Callis, Michael Jack Schmidt. That's just how it is. So I want you guys to know I am a big, big Mike Schmidt fan.
Only the best third baseman that ever played the game.
I agree.
And absolutely. Harry Callis's 500th home run call goes down in the archives not just for Phillies fans, but that goes down in broadcast archives. His 500th homegrown goal.
Yep. And to see Schmidt going up the first baseline and doing the little jump and thing, it was just, I got goosebumps right now just talking about it. That's how much Mike Schmidt means to me. So
that is awesome. Billy, this is really neat, historical, and it is great to speak with somebody who, I'm not gonna give away your age. You're younger. You're far younger than I am. You're a historian of baseball. I think it's awesome. We need young historians of baseball, and I think that is terrific. And I'm glad you're keeping it alive. I love your story. I love how you read all those old publications. What was the oldest one, by the way, that you remember reading that was your grandfather's? What was the date, do you recall?
I want to say it was summertime of the early 20s.
Wow.
I want to say that Ty Cobb was on the cover. He had written a piece in there, and obviously as a small child, Ty Cobb was just an old pitcher to me. Well, and then I'm one of these guys, I ask a lot of questions, and anybody that knows me can testify to that. It's always 20 questions with me. So my grandfather, who took the time, and he was known kind of as a grumpy guy. My grandfather loved him to death. He took the time because I showed the interest, and he explained to me who Tyrus Raymond Cobb was, about how his mother, killed his father, and how he basically forged a letter to Grantland Rice to boost his own status. And it's like, that would never happen in the 21st century. and it just so happened Grantland Rice was a fan of Ty Cobb and gave him that, gave him a little media coverage. The next thing you know, he's well on his way to a legendary career. And Ty Cobb's one of my favorite historical players as well. I think he gets a bad rap. There's a book I need to get that just came out that kind of gives the other side of who Ty Cobb really was and how the media and people around baseball kind of gave him a little bit of a bad rap. Was he a jerk? Of course he was. There were a lot of guys that were jerks that were coming up playing baseball during that era. I mean, not everybody was as happy to be around as Babe Ruth.
I love that you bring up Ty Cobb because I frequently bring him up as one of my absolute favorite baseball heroes of all time. I love Ty Cobb. I love him. You've been, I would suspect, I'm sure you have been, you've been to the Baseball Hall of Fame.
You know what? I have not.
Oh, no.
I have never been to Northern New York in my life. I've been to New York City dozens and dozens and dozens of times. I always told myself I would wait until Don Mattingly got elected. And that's a story for another day. I actually wrote a paper.
I got to tell you, I'll tell you a quick story about the Baseball Hall of Fame. I was up there, I guess it was two, three summers ago. I forget, two or three. Anyhow, if you go to my Facebook page and you go to my photos, there is a whole album up there for the Baseball Hall of Fame. And you can find this one picture that I'm going to bring up. You go through the museum. Now, the museum is separate from the hall. The hall itself is just all the plaques. You go through the museum is three stories high, and you go through different exhibits that they've got, and they try to keep it in a chronological sort of order. However, there is one whole exhibit to Ty Cobb at one point, and you get up to it, and there's this big wall there with glass on it, and it's lit in different areas, and it's highlighting different sections of his career and different things. Well, all the way down on the bottom, near the floor, literally near the floor, on the right-hand side of this exhibit is a handwritten, two-page handwritten letter that he wrote to, I forget exactly who it was, but it was a handwritten letter where he sent an autograph to somebody that had requested one. And it's just a handwritten letter with the envelope. I had to get down and sit down on the floor. I sat there and read the whole letter. And people are walking by me. People are walking by me and having to walk around me because I'm sitting there intently reading this letter that Ty Cobb wrote to this woman or whomever it was. It was like a grandmother of a sick child or something. that wanted, and the child wanted his autograph, and that's what he was doing. He was responding back to it. It gives you a completely different insight into Ty Cobb. It does not go to that stereotypical, you know, alcoholic, you know, nutcase that everybody likes to paint of him.
Yeah.
And I just sat there. I took pictures of it. You can, believe it or not, if you go in on my Facebook page, you find the picture, you can actually read it. You can read the letter. It's there. I was able to blow it up. Yep.
That's awesome. I'll share with you guys real quick my favorite in-person memory of meeting someone of historic relevance. Several years ago, before I had moved to Las Vegas to finish school, I'd gone down for my birthday, which was at the beginning of August, to visit my mom and my stepfather. And I flew in on a Friday, and my stepfather's like, hey, you know, you and I are going for a ride. I was like, where are we going? He goes, we're going to the Stratosphere, which no longer exists. I said, what are we doing? He goes, you'll see. Well, we go, and it's a card show. And I was like, okay, you know, that's cool. Well, I started seeing who was walking through the lobby, and all these Hall of Fame baseball players are lining up in the back of the room, sitting at a table. And there's Bob Gibson, and there's Maury Wills, and Juan Marichal was there. There's just on and on and on. And at the very end of the table sat the chairman of the board, Whitey Ford. And growing up as a kid, all I heard my dad talk about was greatness of Mantle and Ford. Mantle and Ford, Mantle and Ford, Mantle and Ford. So my stepfather flips me a baseball, and he goes, go get in line. I was like, awesome. Well, I wasn't first in line. I was about midway through, and I'm waiting my turn, and guys are growing up and getting autographs from all these guys. No, forget that. I only want to talk to one guy. And when it came to be my turn, the guy who was running the convention said, next, and I'm standing there, and I start shaking. Literally like a crap game, I am shaking. And I break out in a cold sweat, and I'm
uh-huh.
I didn't know what to say, I didn't know what to do. Whitey Ford waves me over. And he reaches out his hand, I shake his hand, we start talking, and it turns out that his grown daughter lives in the same town in New Jersey that my daughter lives in. His daughter happened to be there, and he turns around to her and says, get a folding chair. I want to talk to this young man for a while.
Wow. Like,
Mr. Ford, you don't have to do that. There's, you know, dozens of people waiting for autographs. He goes, let them wait.
Wow.
So I sat there, and I chatted with Whitey Ford for probably close to an hour.
My goodness.
And, yeah, it was just, it was amazing. It was, you know, a guy that, you know, for me, being a guy that covers baseball and have been around a lot of athletes, you know how they tend to be. Not Whitey Ford. And Whitey Ford, to me, is one of the, you know, one of the all-time greats. And for him to take that time with me, because he knew how young I was. He knew I never saw him play. But we shared stories that my dad told me that he would remember from certain games. And he would share inside details. He told me stories about Billy. He told me stories about Mickey. You know, the first time he met Joe DiMaggio. You know, how it was playing for the old man. He always called Casey the old man. And before I knew it, it was like, being able to relate to this Hall of Famer and to be able to share that type of love of the game, the love of the Yankees, was just something I will never, ever forget. I got my dad a signed Whitey Ford ball. We had a picture taken together.
That's
he actually
awesome.
Wrote down his mailing address, and he said, if there's anything else you ever want signed or need, just send it here. And
that
I still
awesome.
Have it, and I've never sent anything to him.
That's awesome. That is great.
Yeah.
Well, we've been talking for a long time here now this evening with Billy Brost, founder. It's interesting to say the founder of kind of a reinvented magazine or a rejuvenated magazine, but it actually is the founder of the modern-day version of Baseball Magazine. You can check it out, please, and we encourage everybody who is listening to this program right now, please get over to baseballmagazine.net. And check out what these guys are doing over there. because you're going to get content and journalistic stories over there that you're not going to find on any other website or any other magazine outlet nowhere. You're not going to find it anywhere. Billy, I absolutely want to get you back in at some point because I would like to get into talking a little bit about today's game versus what it was back in the historical eras. Because as you pointed out, you brought up an issue there a little while ago where I said we could talk for an hour and a half on that one. I would like to get into a little bit of that at some point. So at some point, perhaps maybe before this season is over, I want to get you back in. Can we do that?
Absolutely, absolutely. Anytime you guys need me, just say the word. Thank you so much for having me on and for allowing me to tell the story of Baseball Magazine.
Well, we appreciate it, and we appreciate what you're doing with it. And again, we're encouraging everybody, baseballmagazine.net. Billy, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
You got it. All right, there you go, folks, please. What they're doing over there is really, really unique. And I'm really taken by it. I love it. I just love it. And for right now, it's completely free, so there's no cost to it at all. But there you go, Billy Bruce. Now, for anybody that's out there that wants to jump in with us, wants to give us a holler, we've gotten so caught up in talking about so much stuff here this evening, I have failed to give out the number. 347-826-9964. That's how you can get a hold of us. Pick up your cell phone, pick up your landline, pick up a telephone, 347-826-9964. That's how you can get a hold of us here. If you are listening on a computer and you are Skype capable, hit the little Skype button. It'll put you through to us loud and clear. Otherwise, jump in that chat room. Wow, we've got a load of people over there tonight, and I appreciate that. Or hit me up on Twitter. How about this one right now? I'm going to send out our Twitter poll question of the evening, and I'm going to jump right into this, guys. Here's going to be our Twitter poll question for the evening. Frat House Sports' cleanup hitters MLB poll. Who wins the AL East? Is it the Yankees or the Blue Jays? Who wins the NL East, Mets or Nationals? You can get over to at Frat House Mike, and you can give us a comment there, or please respond to the question that I just put up. All right? Who wins the AL East? Yankees or Blue Jays, who wins the NL East, Mets or Nationals? Respond to that one over at Frat House Mike. And I do want to get into that here, guys, because one of the analyses, in fact, I've read numerous analyses this week. Right now, the Toronto Blue Jays are only a game and a half out of first place. New York Yankees, of course, are leading that. Yankees 61-49. Toronto 61-52. Yankees have got a 3 games in hand, it looks like, advantage there. So, yet, many, many analysts right now are saying, oh, this is over. Toronto Blue Jays are winning the AL East. I know that's not going to make many of our Yankee fans very happy. But I guess considering what happened over the weekend where the Blue Jays swept them, right? Do I have my facts straight on that? Nick, do I have that right?
Double checking for you real quick before I
okay, I think the Blue Jays swept them. And the other the other thing that I wanted to bring up was that apparently I was hearing from one analyst that apparently before this season is over, the Toronto Blue Jays and New York Yankees will have to meet yet. Still, I think something between like 15 to 18 times yet before this season is over. So there's plenty of opportunity for this thing to continue to go back and forth. Now, Nick there was kind of razzing us a little bit in the in our own little private chat room here. Of course, he wasn't razzing you, Sean. I guess he was razzing on Caleb and I from last week, who did not approve of the Toronto Blue Jays being the buyers that they were at the trade deadline. I don't know. What's the thinking from either one of you guys right now on this whole thing? A game and a half out, but the Yankees have got 3 games in hand. What do you think of the analysts that are saying Toronto Blue Jays are going to win this thing. Yankees, they're not going to win the East. What? Go ahead, Nick. Jump in. What do you think?
I know you just mentioned this, but I said this at the deadline. I thought the Blue Jays were huge winners, and it's difficult to deny that at this point when you look at what they've done since the deadline. I don't think they're going to play over 900 baseball for the rest of the season, but in a matter of, I don't remember what the exact numbers are, but in a matter of just a few days, they've made up so much ground behind the Yankees. And they, I mean, you look at their offense, it's the best in baseball. They pick up an ace, which they severely lacked. Mark Burley's having a very good year for a 36-year-old, probably his best in 7 or 8 years. R.A. Dickey has been pitching. He's been real, real hot. He's been pitching very well. This is a team that is really, really, really good. I mean, you look at their lineup 1 through 9, it is really scary. And you look at the Yankees, and here's the thing. The Yankees, during the Blue Jays' little comeback here, it's not like the Yankees have been playing great themselves. And I said back when the Blue Jays were about 7 games out that this division is still tight because the Yankees had this huge hot streak and everybody else in the division was a little cold. Now the Blue Jays are having an incredibly hot streak, and the Yankees are, you know, not playing extremely well. It all balances out. So I think that while I do think the Blue Jays are going to take this division, and by the end of the year, I think it'll be a solid 3-4 game lead. I don't think it's going to come down to exactly the last day of the season, but it might come down to the last week. I do think this is still a tight division. It looks like the Blue Jays are kind of running away with things here, and they started behind, and that's why they're not 8 games up now. But I think at some point the Blue Jays have to cool off, and I'm not saying they cool off back to what they were, but they're not going to win 9 of their last 10 every streak, every series. I mean, at some point they need to cool off, but I do really, really like the Blue Jays here. I think they do hold on to the division. I just don't see them running away with it as everybody else expects, because it's just impractical to expect them to play like this and the Yankees to play like they're playing for another 6 weeks. Also, Mike, I just fact checked you. They did sweep them. The Blue Jays did sweep the Yankees. They also play them this weekend, and they have 10 games left against each other. So that's at least percent of their game.
That 3 games, but Yankees still, like I said, have 3 games in hand. So at some point or another, that's going to have to even up. We'll see how that goes. One of the things that I guess I expressed concern about it at the very, very beginning of the season with the Yankees was their age. And haven't we seen this, it seems to me, from the Yankees before in previous seasons just recently where, hey, all of a sudden they go on a hot streak, they play really well, but I don't know how else you describe it except to say that perhaps maybe, hey, look, it's a long season, and age perhaps maybe catches up with the team, and they just don't have enough to close the deal. Could it be nothing more than that's basically what we're seeing, if, in fact, Toronto should successfully overcome them, and as Nick's pointing out, perhaps maybe get as much as a 3 or 4 game lead. I don't know if it's going to be that close, but I don't know. Sean, what do you think?
I mean, I think I'd have to agree with you there, Mike. I, at the beginning of the season, also said that the Yankees were a very, very old team and were going to have a hard time, keeping up as the weeks went on. And it seems like that might be showing here. Whether or not that's truly the fact why the Yankees are struggling so much, whether it's the tiredness of the age or gaps in their lineup, not necessarily having a starting pitcher, like an ace in their lineup, whereas I was not on the panel next week, but if I had to go with whether the Blue Jays were winners or losers at the trade deadline, I'd have to say that they were winners. Adding a huge bat in Tulowitzki and also adding David Price to the lineup, who's been 2-0 since being with Toronto with a .6 ERA in the 2 starts that he's had with the Blue Jays. So, I mean, went out and they really filled some of the holes that they had in their lineup. Whereas the Yankees, I think they still have holes going into the end of this season. And if they don't do a job in, you know, picking up someone here and there to maybe fill in and get the guys they need, I think Toronto could pull out this season. I think they could, you know, win the division and head out on top. But I have to agree with Nick in that I don't think it's going to be easy. I think there will definitely be a lot of forth as the season continues up until playoffs. So we'll definitely have to keep an eye on this in the coming seasons and see if there's any moves made to help the Yankees at all, or if they're going to stick with what they have and, you know, see where this eventually leads us.
Yeah, and again, I'm going to go back to I'm not sure. I mean, you know, listen, and I'm not going to hold Nick, I'm not going to hold you to this, obviously, but I'm not sure if we're going to necessarily see a 3-4 game lead per se, but we'll see. We'll see, I guess, as it goes. I guess it wouldn't surprise me. Let's put it that way. It wouldn't surprise me if the Blue Jays were to overcome them at this point and take it over. Of course, it doesn't go very far to my argument that I made last week, that I, frankly, was surprised that they were buyers at all and questioned whether, in fact, they really should have been. That doesn't help my case, but that's all right. Let me get over to the other one, though, and the other one's the Mets. We've got analysts out there that, as well, are saying that the New York Mets now are the absolute leaders in the clubhouse, pardon the pun, in the NL East. Mets right now are a game and a half in front of the Washington Nationals. 60-52, the Mets are. Washington right now, 58-53. The Mets adding Cespedes. A lot of people are claiming that was a major, major piece to this, and that really all the Mets have done at this point now has completely cemented the fact that they're going to win the NL East this year. Washington won't even make the playoffs at all. Thoughts, folks, real quick, anybody?
In the beginning of the season, if you remember, we were talking about the Mets for probably the first few weeks of the season, and are they for real, or are they just faking this? And time and time again, at least personally, I quite frankly don't really remember what you and you two and Caleb were saying. But I remember my whole opinion on the Mets was I didn't believe it. I thought that they were going to fall apart. I thought everything was going right, and at some point they had to regress back to the mean. I thought the Nationals were eventually going to kick it into gear. I thought they were getting easy wins against the Braves, Phillies, and Marlins. And I just didn't buy into it. And now you look at it, and I think they are the best team in the NL East. I was never too high on the Nationals, but I saw them winning as many games as they did just because of the lack of competition within the division. But look, the Mets came to play. They put together probably the best starting pitching staff in baseball, or at least the deepest starting pitching staff in baseball. They added Yoenis Cespedes. I thought that was a huge addition. They needed a power bat in the outfield. They went and got it. I still think they lack bullpen strength, which scares me moving into the postseason. But I think they're going to be in the postseason. I do think they take this division, because if you remember, they're still doing all of this without David Wright. And from what I understand, David Wright is set to rejoin the club at some point this year. And whether he's 2008, 2007, 2008, 2009 All-Star David Wright, or he's injury-ridden, getting up there in age, kind of beat down David Wright, I mean, who knows what David Wright they're getting back. But if he can come back and be an above-average third baseman, you're just adding to this team. I think the Braves, the Phillies, and the Marlins stink, and I know the Mets have plenty of games left against them. I think the Nationals, coming into the year, even last year I told you I thought they were highly overrated. You look at this, you just look at the way they're kind of skyrocketing here throughout or within the division. I'd be genuinely surprised if the Mets did not take this division, and it pains me to say that because I am not a fan of the Mets. And for the first half of the season, I didn't think this team was for real. And now I look at it, and I can't believe that at one point during the season, I looked at this team and said they're not the best team in the NL East.
I think I had them third. I'd have to go back and take a look at the preseason rankings, but I believe I had them third. Sean, do you remember where you had them?
Trying to think about it. I think I also had them third, just because I had Atlanta and Philadelphia at the bottom of the league. So I think
right,
I had
exactly.
him third as well. Yeah.
All right, let's get our good buddy Rick on deck in here real quick. Is it working? Rick on deck. Rick, how you doing, buddy?
I am doing great. How are you guys doing tonight?
Real good. We got a couple of minutes here. Go ahead. What's on your mind tonight?
Well, I mean, great analysis, I think, on the Yankee-Toronto discussion there. I think I'm on board with Toronto winning that division. I think when it comes down to it, when you have tight races, the key moves at trade deadline typically sways things one way or the other. Either you make the right moves or you don't. I think Toronto actually made the right moves. Obviously, Tulowitzki has injected, you know, even more into that offense. And also picking up, you know, a frontline pitcher bolsters their pitching staff. So I think, as I've said before, I think on this program, I think Toronto is a well-balanced team, and I kind of like well-balanced teams rather than somebody that's either hitter heavy or pitching heavy. Which brings us to the discussion about the Mets, which I think that, again, here's a team that made the right move at the trade deadline in getting Cespedes with Wright coming back off the DL. I think Nick hit that right on the head. That will only bolster their offense even more. So now you take one of the best pitching staffs in the league and add a little bit of offense to it. Not sure Washington is going to have the horses to take them to the finish line. So I think, you know, I would be on the side of thinking the Mets are going to finish out strong and take the division.
Let me ask you this, though, Rick, from your perspective, which one, if not both, the Yankees, Blue Jays battle going on up there, and if the Blue, let's just say for a moment that the Blue Jays end up taking the AL East, and let's say the Mets end up taking the NL East, which one of those would you say comes to you as the biggest surprise as you were going into the season way back at the end of March and early April?
I would have to say probably the Blue Jays. You know, I think the weakness of the NL East, you know, really had Washington. I think everybody was thinking Washington was going to win that division, but, you know, in reality, I, again, agree with Nick's point that I didn't think Washington was, you know, the strongest team in the National League. I think that a lot of that has to do with playing in a weaker division where you build up a lot of interdivision wins. Toronto, on the other hand, is playing in, you know, what I had thought would be a really tough division. Now, Boston didn't, you know, perform as I thought that they would, you know, going into the season. Mm-hmm. But I certainly didn't expect Toronto to be at the top of the heap. I mean, they're a team that's, for the last few years, been, you know, an okay team, but one who's kind of, you know, fallen off to the middle of that division as things got hot and heavy later in the summer. So I'd say probably Toronto is the bigger surprise to me. You know, again, I think the Mets having the pitching staff that they've put together, they just needed a little bit of offensive push, and I think they might be getting it. You know, that's the thing that I like about the move that they made, again, getting Cespedes and getting a little bit more pop in that lineup. And whenever you add a player and they come in, there's a domino effect. I mean, you know, other guys might not have as much pressure on them. They might be, you know, slide down in the lineup or whatever, and things start clicking a lot better. And it looks like the Mets made the right move.
Nick and Sean, from both you, which one comes as a bigger surprise? Because I'm looking at it and I'm saying, okay, you know, if I recall correctly, and I'm going to do this, before, you know, right as we near the end of the season, I'm going to go back to all of our predictions back on those preseason shows that we made, if you might remember. I'm going to go back and pull all those because I've got them all annotated. I believe over in the AL East, I kind of thought that Baltimore would come out on top, and yet I wasn't real solid on that. But one thing I was solid on, as Rick pointed out, I was solid pretty much on the Nationals being the NL East winner, because I think all of us had kind of sat back and said, oh, this division is just so horrible. It's got to be Washington by default. Washington, the Mets actually, I think winning this division, if in fact they do, is the bigger of the two surprises for me. What about you guys?
I'd have to agree with you, Mike. I think as far as preseason analyses went, I think this is definitely the big question mark in the works, is the fact that we all did have Washington winning the division. I know a lot of sports outlets. I read Sports Illustrated, and they had an article about the AL East that said that Washington was going to easily take the division. Everyone thought that Washington was going to easily take this division. But now we have this Mets team who's got a very good foundation as far as a pitching staff is concerned. As Nick said, it's a very deep pitching staff. And, you know, they've got some offense rolling. So if they can keep that up going into the end of the season and end up winning this division, I think that would come as the biggest surprise out of this season.
Nick, would you say the same? Or perhaps maybe you say, no, the AL thing is a surprise to you, that ultimately it might turn out to be Toronto. I don't know. What do you think?
No, I think the Mets are the bigger surprise when you look
at
the division.
Yep, there you go.
I thought the Nationals were more of a lock in their division than any team in the AL East was. And I think in the preseason, you look at the AL East, and not necessarily that anybody really had their heart set on the Blue Jays, but it was a little tighter. In the NL East, it was almost consensus that the Nationals were the first-place team. And then even beyond that, there were plenty of guys, including myself, that didn't even have the Mets in second place. And I remember foolishly I put the Marlins in second place, so I'm still trying to figure out what I was thinking.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, I'm glad you brought it up. We'll get into that a little bit later on as we move through the season. Yet, wow, you just reminded me of that. I've got to have to come up with a good sound drop for that one. before I let you go, Rick, real quick, let me get your thoughts on something. One of the other topics I had on the agenda. We're running tight on time here, but one of the other topics I had on the agenda for this evening, and I'll get the other guys as thoughts on it as well. Apparently, Chase Utley is still being looked at for potential movement yet before this season is over. Apparently the Giants are still expressing some interest. Hey, Rick, what do you think about that? The Giants need to have their head examined, don't they?
I disagree with that to some extent. I'm not sure if the Giants are exactly the right fit, because I think their second baseman is only out for a couple of weeks. So I'm not sure if they're kind of looking for the Cody Ross, you know, shot in the arm or not from Utley, which I think that there are other teams that might benefit. And one of them, although the team's already long in the tooth, I think the Yankees could really benefit from a player like Utley, because I think the Yankees, in order to maintain the lead in the East, they're going to have to make a waiver wire move or a post waiver wire move. I mean, there's got to be something that they do to inject something, you know, some life into their lineup. So that's an interesting team, although I know, you know, they are an older team, but you're looking for kind of like that you know, shot just for that last month of the season, and Utley might be able to provide that. I mean, it really depends on how much of an effect that ankle had on the first part of the season. He looks pretty good right now, but, you know, if he can maintain that for another couple of weeks, I think some team's going to reach out and try to make a deal for him. And I don't think that's too far-fetched.
What's the deadline on the waiver wire? Isn't it the end of this month?
Well, Utley cleared waivers. So,
okay.
But you have to make a deal before the 31st.
Right.
Yeah, I think so.
That's what I thought. Yeah. But before the 31st.
Yep.
All right, so, Nick, real quick, Rick on deck seems to think that Utley might be serviceable for a team. I think any team that be looking at Utley is out of their mind. What do you think?
I think it depends on the role you put him in. As an everyday starting second baseman for the next 4 years, yeah, you know, find a shrink. But if you're, you know, just want that veteran guy, if he's going to platoon, if he's going to come off the bench, if he's it depends on the role. You mentioned the Giants. Rick mentioned the Yankees. One of the teams I saw today that might have interest is the Cubs, now that Addison Russell is their definitive shortstop. Starlin Castro is getting work at second base today, but for the most part, they've moved on from Starlin Castro. I hear they're looking for a second baseman, and I heard that Utley's on their radar. So I see a couple teams that maybe you could find a fit for him, but at the same time, I'd be shocked if he gets moved and the Phillies don't have to eat any of the salary, or at least I'd be shocked if Utley gets moved and the Phillies don't eat a large portion of the salary and get at all a valuable return. I mean, he might be moved, and I could see a team going for him, but it's not going to cost them much.
Sean, does he get moved or doesn't he?
The one thing I would like to add back into this conversation is the fact that Utley does have a no-trade clause, so for him to get moved, he would have to accept any trade offer to any team that he would want. So I think that's another thing that's going to come into play is, you know, whether or not Chase Utley actually wants to leave Philadelphia, because if he doesn't, then he's not going to leave because he has the no trade clause. However, I do think everyone brought up a lot of good teams to which he could be serviceable. So is he serviceable? Yes. Will he be gone? It's hard to say. I don't know if anyone's going to really have a need for him by the come of the, come end of season. So we'll just have to see where that goes, I guess, over the next month.
You got it. Rick on Deck, thanks for joining us again this evening. We got about a little bit over 5 minutes left in the program, so I'm going to be starting to wrap things up. I appreciate you jumping in with us here again this evening.
My pleasure. My pleasure. And the 22-year-old who didn't know who Mike Schmidt was, shame on you.
Yeah, mercifully, Billy didn't give his name out on air, so we won't be able to troll him tonight on Twitter.
Bye, no.
Rick.
All right, talk to you later.
Before I start to wrap things up, I made a promise to everyone here, including our own Nick right here on the panel, that I would come back to this topic at least one more time 3 weeks after the fact, and that was that 3 weeks ago this evening I made the comment right here that if, in fact, the trade deadline were to have been pushed back to about the middle of August, I would like to take a look at what team records were at this time and compare them what they were at that time and see if there would be additional buying teams. Well, I did my analysis, and I must be honest. Here are the teams that I identified as being buyers in the American League. This was back on July 21st. I identified the Yankees, the Orioles, Blue Jays, Kansas City Royals, Minnesota Twins, Los Angeles Angels, and the Houston Astros. Those were my AL teams. NL teams I had identified 3 weeks ago as being potential buying teams. The Nationals, the Mets, the Cardinals, the Pittsburgh Pirates, Chicago Cubs, Dodgers, and Giants. I got to be honest with you, as of this moment right now today, based upon where the standings are, I would probably only remove two from that list. I would remove the Baltimore Orioles, who were, as of last night, and I'm just looking, let me look at the standings right now, has it changed? Yes, it has. Baltimore Orioles right now are 57-54, and I would remove the Minnesota Twins, who are right now 55-56. So I guess in hindsight, it didn't make that much of an impact, I would say. We're removing two. I mean, if you count those up, I think there were 14 buying teams the way I identified it. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Yeah, 7 on each side. So I had 14 buying teams. So by pushing it up 3 weeks from where we were talking about it before to now, I'm basically only saying, well, there'd be a difference. It would be about 12. Just wanted everybody to know. I truth in journalism, folks. I wanted to make sure I got back and did my due diligence on that one. Nick, you're right. That was very difficult for me to say. You could give me a nice big hearty pat on the back or something to that effect. But anyhow, all right, let's do this. Let's get around to our Series Streak Challenge is a little game we've been playing every week since the beginning of the season. We pick a team right here on the panel. We pick a team that we believe will win a series for the coming week. We prefer it to be an upset. But if it's, we'll stretch it a little bit if it is a reason. Right now, current record. I'm leading the pack, 11-7. Nick, you're 10-8. Caleb is 9-9. Sean is 8-10. It couldn't get much closer than that. Everybody's a difference of a game.
I think Caleb, we all won last week too, didn't we?
We absolutely, every single one of us won. So did
so
not
no
really
movement.
Right, it didn't change the standings at all. Caleb got in touch with me and said that he is picking the Blue Jays over the Yankees for this weekend. Sean, what say you? Let's make it a good pick here, buddy.
I'm going with the Phillies.
Uh-oh. He's pulling.
Over the Brewers.
He's going to pull a Nick. Phillies over the Brewers.
I'm really loving this Phillies team right now, and I'm just hoping they win.
It worked for Nick. Watch, it will not work.
Well, it worked for me once. At the very beginning of the season, I said they would beat the Braves, and they did. I had that gut feeling, and I'm just feeling it again. So, fingers crossed.
Go ahead, Nick. Where are we going?
Sean, congrats on this week's win. I'm going with the Phillies, too. They played. They got the Brewers this weekend. I like them. They've been playing hot baseball, and I went to them last week. They did me well, picked up a valuable win. Mike, I'm right on your heels, man. You better watch out. And Sean's right behind me, too. Sean's coming, too.
I'm coming. All the way from first to last to first again.
Lightning does not strike twice. You might think it does, but it does not strike twice. Wow. I had a comment, and I forgot what it was. It just left my mind. Anyhow, that's all right. Here we go. I'm going to go out on a limb, guys. I'm surprised. I was surprised I wasn't going to have opposition on this from the completely opposite direction. I'm going to take the Mets this week over the Pirates. There you go. There's our Series Streak Challenge. You can get the graphic. It'll be up within minutes of this show concluding. You'll be able to find it over on our Facebook page. Frat House Sports, leave spaces in between. Look for our little purple icon and give us a like there. Frat House Sports on Facebook. Want to thank Billy Bros for spending so much time with us this evening. Would encourage everybody please to get over. Check out his revitalized baseball magazine at www.baseballmagazine.net. And give Billy your thoughts and your comments. What he's doing over there is incredibly innovative and really, really cool stuff as he, reinvigorates a historical publication in the 21st century in a digital world. Many thanks to you guys as well. Many thanks to all of our listeners this evening and all of our callers, Richard from New York, Rick on deck as well, and everybody that's been listening out there tonight. Great audience tonight. We appreciate it. Make sure you are here with us on Thursday evening. Boy, we have got quite a program that is shaping up for you on Thursday night. Our flagship program, the Frat House Sports Show, number 205. It is going to have a heavy, heavy, heavy flavor of fantasy sports as we will be introducing our very own Frat House Sports football fantasy football analyst who will be joining us regularly. You'll get introduced to them. We'll be joined hopefully by Bernie Nichols, 18-year NHL veteran, who's going to be coming in to talk to us about his, DraftKings alternative, all sports market. We're going to be talking a little bit about that, and we're also going to be talking with some folks, friends of ours and people out there who regularly play DraftKings and FanDuel. We're going to get into a lot of fantasy stuff. You're going to want to be here for that one, 7 p.m. Eastern Time, the Frat House Sports Show. In the meantime, you know what you got to do. Get out there and enjoy your baseball.